final shir of the Kollel. Let me just take a moment to just acknowledge, first of all the Chavrei Kollel who were here and participated and who enriched me in my learning, all the people who participated in the morning shirim, really added a new dimension to our learning in Hachana and in the shir itself, and all of you who are here tonight and the entire community who really welcomed us, those who opened their homes to us, and who've had us for meals, and the entire Avira here, the environment has been really one of warmth and support, and we're all very, very grateful to you. This is actually a shir that originally here and participated and who enriched me in my learning. All the people who participated in the morning shirim really added a new dimension to our learning in Hachana and in the shir itself. And all of you who are here tonight and the entire community who've really welcomed us, those who opened their homes to us and who've had us for meals, and the entire Avira here, the environment has been really one of warmth and support, and we're all very, very grateful to you. This is actually a shir that originally was scheduled to be given tomorrow morning. It was slated for the Monday shir. Because of some scheduling problems, we decided to use the evening now for the final shir of the series on Birkat Kohanim. And the title was Birkat Kohanim as Dream Therapy. Last Shabbos here in the shul, I discussed dreams in general and the approach that emerges from the Gemara toward dreams. Do we take them seriously? Do we not take them so seriously? We also spoke very briefly about some of the halachic responses to dreams. We mentioned Tanis Chalom. We also mentioned Hatavas Chalom. Hatavas Chalom means bettering of a dream. And there are two forms of Hatavas Chalom. One is when you have three people, you declare before them, I have had a good dream, and they support you, they reinforce that perception, and they in turn respond, you've had a good dream, and they recite a series of psukim. The second is what we're going to deal with tonight, and that's a special tefillah that's recited during the time of Birchas Kohanim. When the Kohanim are doing what they're doing, they're blessing, they're reciting the passages of psukim, Yivarecha Hashem v'yishmerecha, at that time, the congregation recites a tefillah specifically designed for Hashem transforming their dreams into something positive. I have a series of handouts. If you don't have one, we're out of them, but try to find somebody sitting next to you who has a handout so that hopefully everybody will be able to look on. There should be enough to go around if people share. What I'd like to look at specifically is how this tefillah originated and evolved to what we have today. For example, if we look at our typical standard art school siddur, and we have many here, and there are more here in front if you want to get a couple more, we notice an interesting thing. First of all, when is the tefillah recited? Ribono shel olam, ani shelach, v'chalom asai shelach. Where do we have the tefillah inserted? Again, if you're missing handouts, try to find somebody next to you who has a handout. We have it mentioned how many times? Ribono shel olam, the prayer that begins Ribono shel olam, twice. The first is at the conclusion of the first pasuk at v'yishmerecha. The second at the conclusion of the second pasuk at v'chuneka. At the conclusion of the third pasuk, we have some other tefillah that begins with Yehi Ratzon. If we look at the Gemara, though, we don't get the sense at all. And that's what I'd like to trace with you, how this tefillah originated and what's been written about it to the point of today and how we conduct ourselves today. After that, we'll look at some of the specific aspects of the tefillah, the actual nusach of the tefillah. And at that point, I'd just like to conclude with a few words about dreams in general that I didn't have a chance to say a week ago on Shabbos. So let's begin on sheet number one. This is the Gemara in Brachos, and Daf Nun Hey on the base. It's the part of the page that's bracketed off in the middle of the page. The Gemara begins by telling us, Amemar umazutra v'rav Ashi haviyasvi bahadi hadadi. The three rabbis, Amemar, Mazutra, Rav Ashi, were sitting together. Amri, they said, Kochad b'chad minan lema milsa d'loshmiya le'lechavrei. Let each of us share something that no one else has heard. Something new, a new halacha. Pasachad minayil v'amar. One of them began with the following statement. Hayman d'chazachelma. Somebody has a dream. V'lo yada maychaza. He doesn't know what is it that he saw. Leikum kami kahani. He should stand up before the Kohanim in their presence, the idna de parsi yadayu, at the time that they spread out their hands, in other words, when they're duchening, the lei mahachi, he should say the following tefillah, Ribono shel olam, master of the world, ani shelach, I am yours, v'chalom asai shelach, and my dreams are yours. Chalom chalamti, I've dreamt a dream, v'eini yodea mahu. I don't know what it is, don't know what it means. Bein shechalamti ani la'atzmi, whether it was a dream that I dreamt about myself. Bein shechomu li chaveirai, or whether it was a dream that my neighbors, my friends, dreamt about me. Bein shechalamti al acherim, or whether it was a dream that I dreamt about others. Im tovim heim, if these dreams symbolize something good, they portend a positive outcome. Chazkein v'amtsein, strengthen them. As the dreams of Yosef came to fruition. V'mtzrichim refuah, if they need some sort of remedy, rafim, then heal them. K'mei mara ayidei Moshe Rabbeinu, as you did the water of Mara, the bitter waters of Mara through Moshe, u'chemiryam mitzarata, and as you healed Miriam from her leprosy, u'chechizkiyo mechoyo, and chizkiyo when he was ill, ukimei Yericho ayidei Elisha, and the words of Yericho through Elisha. Ukishem shehafachta kilas Bilam harasha livracha, just as you transformed the curse of Bilam, the evil Bilam, for blessing, ken hafoch kol chalom l'sai alai l'tova. So shall you transform all of my dreams for me for a good outcome. Umesayim bahadi kahani da'ani tzibura amen. And you should conclude this tefillah, this prayer, at the moment that the Kohanim complete their tefillah, when they say Shalom, so that when the congregation responds Amen, it will be together. It would be on the Kohanim, on the Birkas Kohanim, and also on the tefillah that you've just said for dreams. The Ilo, and if not, Lei Mahachi, he should say the following. Adir Vamorom Shochin Bigvura, Ata Shalom, Mishimcha Shalom, Yehi Ratzon Lefanecha Shetasim Aleinu Shalom. What does the Ilo mean, and if not? What is if not? Simply it means, if there's not enough, in other words, there's still more time, you're supposed to conclude the Ribono Shel Olam prayer together with the Kohanim. Suppose you daven very quickly, and you've already completed it, and there's still time, and the Kohanim have not yet finished Birchas Kohanim, then you should add the following tefillah of Adi Mabarom, Shochin Bigvura, you are peace, your name is peace, you should place peace among us, and at that point you should at least be concluding along with the Kohanim. If you look at the little Aleph here, that refers us to the Hagos Hagra, which is on the right margin. He points out that there was another version, rather than the Ilo, the Rif had the Chimahadri Kahani Apayu Leimahachi. When the Kohanim turned their faces back to face the Aron Kodesh, it's at that point that you should recite Adir Bamaram. So it's not just if you don't have time, in other words, you finish too early. It means that every single time when the Kohanim turn around, and what happens when the Kohanim turn around, we discuss this in the morning, they have a tefillah to say as well. That's a tefillah of Ribono Shel Olam, Asinu Mashe Gazarta Aleinu, and you find this again in the Artsgro Siddur on page 700. There are a couple of Artsgro Siddurs here in the front, so you can pass them back. At that moment, when the Kohanim are reciting their extra bracha, their extra tefillah, they've turned around, that's when you should also say Adir Bamaram. So we have two different versions of the Adya Bamaram? Is it only recited when you've finished too early with your tefillah for dreams, or is it recited all the time when the Kohanim turn around? When we look at this Gemara, do we have any sense of when this tefillah should be recited? What is the impression that one gets when one reads the Gemara? It notes that you should conclude your tefillah when the Kohanim conclude their Birchas Kohanim. It doesn't tell us anything about when you should recite the tefillah. Presumably, when would it be recited then? What would be the sense that you would get from the Gemara? During the time that the Kohanim are doing their Birchas Kohanim, at the very same moment, you'll be reciting this tefillah of Ribono Shel Olam, as long as you conclude your tefillah about the dreams together with the Kohanim. Is there any sense of how many times the tefillah should be recited? What would be the impression one would be left with? Once. Doesn't say anything about reciting the tefillah any more than once. And you have more than enough time to say it. People complain very often. I've heard this. The Kohanim didn't sing long enough because I still have more to say. And then they would say, well, we just picked up where we left off in that paragraph for the next time, from Vichuneka. If you started when the Kohanim began, there's certainly more than enough time to get through it. That's the sense that we get from our Gemara. The problem with this is raised by the Mefarshim based on something the Gemara says in Sota on page number 2. If you notice again in the Arch Scroll Siddur, page 696 and 698, after each word you see a specific pasuk, Yivarechecha, Yivarecha Hashem Yitzion Osei Shemayim Va'aretz. Hashem, Hashem Adonenu Mardishimcha B'chol Ha'aretz. With each word, there's a specific pasuk that's attached to it. Presumably, that's there for somebody to be saying at the time that either the Kohanim or the Shliach Tzibur is reciting that word. Where does this originate, and is it the proper thing to do to recite psukim at the time of Birchas Kohanim? On page number 2, the Gemara in Sota lists many of these psukim, but then cites the following opinion. It's about 10 lines or so from the top. Amar Rav Chiya bar Abba, where it's underlined, Kol ha'omran digvulin eino ela toa. If somebody recites these passages, these psukim, outside the Beis HaMikdash, he is mistaken. It's not appropriate to say these psukim at the time of Birchas Kohanim. Amar Rabbi Chanina bar Papa, Teda, I'll prove it to you. The Mikdash Nami lo mibayli mimrinu. Even in the Beis HaMikdash, when Birchas Kohanim was performed in its original form, it wasn't proper to say these psukim. Why? For the following reason. Kulum yesh lecha eved shemivarchim also ve'eno ma'azin? Have you ever seen a servant who is being blessed and he's not paying attention? When Birchas Kohanim is being performed by the Kohanim, Hashem Kaviyacho is blessing the congregation, the Jewish people. What should one be doing when he's being blessed? Should be showing respect and be silent and pay attention. It's inappropriate to be saying anything, to be reciting psukim. Based on this, it would seem not so appropriate for us to recite this tefillah for dreams either. In fact, when it comes to these psukim, for this very reason, many shuls have the practice not to recite psukim. For this very reason, it's not appropriate to recite the psukim during the time of Birkas Kohanim. Those that do recite the psukim try to do it not when the Kohanim are reciting the word, but rather as the Shliach Tzibur prompts the Kohanim with each word, during that second, that's when the psukim are said, but not when the Kohanim are actually engaged in the bracha itself. If so, how do we allow the recitation of an entire paragraph of Ribono Shel Olam, Ani Shelach, I'm yours and my dreams are yours? It seems to be in contradiction to this Gemara. Tosfos here points out this question. Tosfos on the margin asks the question. Pirush Ri, Afo Gav De Amrina B'Perek HaRoeh. Although we've seen in the end of Brachos, Perek HaRoeh, the following Gemara, Haiman Dechazi Chelma, one who's seen a dream, etc. Answers Tosfos, Dehasa Mishum Sakana Hitiru. Over there, they permitted reciting this paragraph because of the danger involved. If one had a bad dream, it's dangerous. How can one prevent the danger, neutralize the impact of the dream, the negative dream, through this tefillah? It has a power. If someone is in danger, we allow certain things that we don't normally allow, that we don't permit. It's not appropriate just to say a pasuk. But if your life is in danger, or there's any possibility of danger, then we permit it. Tosus proves it. Tosus says, Shema chalom mesukanhu. It may be a dream which involves something dangerous to your life. Shetzerech refuah, as the tefillah indicates, heal them. We have seen that one is permitted to fast on Shabbos for a bad dream of Friday evening. We know that fasting on Shabbos is prohibited, even min HaTorah, according to most opinions. And yet, because of the nature of the danger involved, we permitted fasting on Shabbos. So too, we permitted reciting a paragraph, a special tefillah, because we know that there's something unique about this moment when the Kohanim stand before the Tzibur and bless them. Therefore, that moment is the appropriate time to say the tefillah for chalomos, for atavas chalom. Once again, based on this Tosfos, what would be the sense of when the tefillah is recited? During the time of Birchas Kohanim. It was a special dispensation that the rabbis gave us, the Chazal gave us, to recite a tefillah for chalomos during the time of Birchas Kohanim. However, and again, the sense is that you recite the tefillah once, and only once. Where then do we get our minhag to say the tefillah twice, or maybe three times, as we'll see? And where do we get the minhag to start using reciting the tefillah only at a certain point in time, toward the end of the bracha? The first reference to this you'll find on page number 3. It's not in the Rambam himself, because the Rambam, interestingly enough, makes no mention of this Gemara. The Rambam, in general, is more of a rationalist, as we know. The Rambam doesn't quote this Gemara lehalacha at all, the special tefillah for chalomos. However, in the Hagos Maimonios, on the bottom of the page, on the second line, the Rambam has just stated here, on the third line, on the top, that the people should be listening attentively to Birchas Kohanim, should not divert their attention. And this point that goes by Monio says on the bottom in letter Hey, V'lo yomar ha-psukim ha-mefurashim be'eun emarim. One shouldn't recite the psukim that are mentioned in the Gemara and Perek Eun emarim. As the Gemara says there, the Amar of Chizda, kol ha-omar b'gvulin eino elatoa. One is mistaken if he recites these psukim. V'hine mori rabbeinu, my rabbi, my rebbe, ragil omar, v'shash ha-omrim v'yishmerecha, v'chuneka, and what should be said is v'shalom, at the time that the Kohanim are concluding each of the three brachos of Birchas Kohanim, v'yishmerecha, v'chuneka, and shalom, that's when he used to say, ribono shalom, ani shalach, v'chalom asai shalach, and so on, as the Gemara says. He's the first one to introduce saying this tefillah not once, but three times, and linking it to the conclusion of each pasuk, at the Yishmerecha, at the Chuneka, and Shalom. If you look at the next page, number 4, in the Tur Shulchan Aruch, the Tur quotes the Gemara, as stated, and the Beis Yosef in the right margin quotes on the top line what we've just read, the Hagos Maimonios. And then he quotes on the fourth line, the Trumas Hadeshen, who points out that one should try to say this tefillah, B'shah Shemarichin B'kaf Tevi Yishmerecha and B'chuneka. Imagine, people complain there's not enough time as it is. He tried to have this tefillah squeezed in to the last syllable of the Yishmerecha, that last syllable, so that to get around this problem, so that you're not saying the tefillah during the recitation of the Birchas Kohanim per se, but you're still within the time and the context of Birchas Kohanim because they haven't quite finished the word. The Yishmerecha. That last cha gives you the opportunity to say this paragraph. And this is his source for this is the Gemara that we've read. Yesh Evet Sherabo Mevarcho Ve'eno Masbir Lo Panim. Shouldn't the slave, the servant, be attentive to what's being said to him? What about the third word, Shalom? You can't stretch out Shalom. Can't do it. You can do it V'chunech Ka Ishmerecha. You can't do Shalom. You said it. When you said it, you said it. Okay, we do what we can do. So when you get there, you just say it when they're saying Shalom. But when it comes to the other two words, you try to wait till the last syllable so that you haven't quite said it when the word is being said. It's only when the word is being ended. Then the Beis Yosef quotes the next paragraph, will be Tshuva Ashkenazis. In the Tshuvas Maharil, he found the following. That it's not such a question to begin with. The fact that the Gemara says that it's not appropriate to say psukim because you're not paying attention, that's because it's not necessarily related directly to Birchas Kohanim when you say a pasuk that connects in some way to the theme of the word. But if you're saying a tefillah which shows that Birchas Kohanim has a power to transform your dreams, that very tefillah shows that you believe in Birchas Kohanim. If you believe in it, then it's appropriate for you to say the tefillah, because the tefillah itself indicates that you're taking the Birchas Kohanim seriously. This is essentially what he says. Yesh l'chalek d'chashiv shafir mazin lo. It's considered like you're paying attention. Shemarev atzmo d'mekabel Birchas Kohanim. You are indicating through your tefillah that you are receiving the Birchas Kohanim. U'mishem hachi kamar reish yiskayim bo Birchas Kohanim. And that's why you're saying that you want it fulfilled, b'yishapei chalomo, so that your dream be transformed. And the Beis Yosef further on, if you see, agrees with this reason. V'lu nira tam rishon de tshuva zu ikar. This first reason that he just read is the right reason. The keva de birkas kohanim yesh la koach letaken chalom ra. Since birkas kohanim has inherently a power to remedy a bad dream, kishim mispalim alav ba'osa shah, when you pray for it at that moment, havishapir me'inyan birkas kohanim, you are doing something which is appropriate for the occasion. The havi evet sherabo mevarcho, you have a servant whose master blesses him, v'hu ma'azin lo, and he's paying attention, u'mazbir lo panim, and he's thankful. Yes, we'll see that in a moment. Are we restricted to people who've had dreams? Don't forget, Birchas Kohanim is done, basically it should be performed every day. In fact, in Eretz Yisrael it's done every day. Outside of Eretz Yisrael, by Sfardim it's done every day. Can you imagine every day somebody saying this? Is there always a need to say this on a daily basis? Or is it only when you think or you know that you've had a dream that needs some sort of intervention, divine intervention? Right. We'll see about that point in a moment. Let's look on page number 5. So what have we seen thus far? We've seen from the Gemara, from Tosfos, it sounds as if the tefillah should be recited only once during the actual performance of Birkas Kohanim, while the Kohanim are reading the words. But then we've seen Hagos Maimonios, who restricts it to the end of the pasuk. He doesn't say the last syllable, he says the last word, and he has it done 3 times. Then we've seen the Trumas Hadeshen, who has you saying this tefillah for the last syllable. And then we've seen the Maharil, who doesn't have much of a problem saying it because it's not inappropriate to say this tefillah, since the tefillah itself indicates your confidence in Birchas Kohanim as something which will have a positive effect on you and on your dreams. Let's look what happens in the Shulchan Aruch. On page number 5, on the left side, it's in the middle of Sif Mem He, where it's underlined. The Rama points out the Omrim Ribon. You say the tefillah called Ribon, Ribono Olamim, Ribono Shalom, Kimosha Meforesh B'Simon Kuf Lamed, as is explained in Simon Kuf Lamed, which we'll see in a moment. When should you say it? B'Sha Shemarichin B'Nigun HaTevos Shebesof HaPsukim. At the time that the Kohanim are stretching out with some melody the words at the end of the Pesukim. They're stretching out Yishmerecha, Vichunecha, and Shalom. As they are stretching out the words, you should say the Ribono Shel Olam. Again, not quite what we do. As the Kohanim are stretching out the Yishmerecha, they do some sort of a melody stretching out the words, so they're reciting the words, but they take a long time in reciting the words, and that gives you the opportunity to say the Ribbon. If you look, I'm sorry? On page 5A, on the left, you see Kuf Lamed, Simon Kuf Lamed. This is a heading, Ribbono Shel Olam, She'omrim B'Shas Nesiyas Kapayim. That's the heading. And the Mechaber simply quotes the Gemara for us. Manda Chaza Chelma, one who sees a dream and doesn't know what he's seen, should say the following. We have no sense of when it should be said. If we read the Mechaber here, there's no indication at what point should the tefillah be said. What is interesting though on 5b, on the right side, is what the Rama points out about the ability to say this tefillah when there is no formal Birchas Kohanim. Today, we only have Birchas Kohanim Yom Tovim, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Yom Tovim. Do you have to wait that long to ward off the effects of a bad dream? If a person is really concerned about a dream they've had, is there another way, another opportunity that they may have to say this tefillah? Yes. The Rama says, "V'makom she'en olin l'duchan, yomar kol zeh b'shah she'hashatz omer sim shalom." On a regular basis, the chazan starts sim shalom. That's a tefillah, the final bracha of Shmona Esrei, which contains the theme of Birkat Kohanim. That's also an appropriate time to say the tefillah of Ribbono Shel Olam, the very same tefillah. And when should he conclude? When the chazan concludes the bracha of sim shalom, the yisayim, Bahadish Shliach Tzibur, together with the Chazan, Shiyanu Had Kahal Amen, just as we saw with respect to Birkat Kohanim, concluding it together with the Kohanim, you should conclude your tefillah with the Chazan. The issue that you raised a moment ago about somebody who has not necessarily had dreams is raised here by the Taz on the left side of the margin, Gimel. He points out, Lo Ra'isi Nohagim Kain. I haven't seen people doing this. I mean, they didn't duchen except for Yantif. He never saw people in shul in the morning saying this tefillah during Sim Shalom, except for a few individuals. So he explains the reason for that would be because it's only if somebody had a dream that previous night or knows that he's had a dream within the last recent past that needs some sort of intervention, that's when one should recite it. One should not recite it just like that. That's why, for example, even for us, when you have Yantif Sheni, so you've already said the Ribbon on the first day Yantif, it may not be appropriate to say it the second day Yantif, because you've already done it the first day. That's what he says toward the end. Alkein ra'oi l'nhog, shelo yomar b'chol yom Ribbono Shel Olam. When its lines get wide, about three lines down. A person shouldn't say this every day. Ela imbolo chalom b'layla shelefanav. If you had a dream the night before, Mashenkin b'shas haregel, but when a time of chag, yom tovim, sha'olin l'duchan, yachal omar osa afil min hastam. Then ordinarily you can say it because you've definitely had some dreams between one chag and the other. And you definitely had dreams that probably need some sort of fixing in some way or another. Sorry? Yes, I mentioned this on Shabbos. In fact, we know, it's been proven, that we dream each and every night, not just once, but many times. So does this task become now obsolete halacha or not? We've dreamt, but there may not have been a dream that needs any special type of intervention. Is it for a dream that you have concern about, or is it just because, why not? I've had dreams anyway, I might as well say something to help them out. Or is it only because you're disturbed about the dream and... I'm not sure. But going back to the earlier issue, when should one say this tefillah? And going back to what we do, what you see here in the art scroll, where did this originate? The first, what we see here on page number 6, in the Bir Halacha of the Chavetz Chaim, we find a reference finally to what we do. What do we do? The Chazan already has prompted the Kohanim with the final word of the Pasuk, Vishmerecha. The Kohanim have not yet responded, and during that interval, they don't yet respond. They either remain silent or they sing a niggun. And during that time, the niggun we all know, the most famous one, ay-ya-ya-ya-ya-ya-ya-ya. So this, during that time, everyone has an opportunity to say Ribono Shel Olam. This creates another problem in its own right. And this is what the Bir Halacha points out. Look at the Bir Halacha here on page 6. Ubimdino Seinu, on the top line, Nohagim HaKahol Omar HaRibon, Acha Kriyas HaMakre Teva Achrona Shel Kol Pasuk. It's after the Kore, the reader, calls out the final word of each Pasuk, the Akonim Shotkim Az, they're silent, O Minagim, or they sing. The Acha Shemesayim HaTzibor HaRibon, and when the people have, hopefully, the Kohanim will give them enough time, but when they conclude the paragraph of Ribon, Mesayimim HaKohanim HaTeva HaAchrona, then they go ahead and finish, conclude the pasuk with the final word. Umin HaGzeh Yeshbo Chora Tam Tzas. This has something of a rationale. Kidei Sheyuchu Acha Kach HaKohol LaHazin HaTev HaBracha Mipi HaKohanim. In order that the people can afterwards hear the word recited. All of the other things that we've seen, you're missing something. You're missing a word. You're missing a syllable. You're not hearing the Kohanim enunciate the entire word. Maybe it may not be such a problem to begin with, as we saw, because if it's such an important tefillah and it has such an impact, then it may not be such a problem. But nevertheless, we try to minimize the problem. And in this case, we've done that, apparently, because you've heard every single word from the Kohanim's mouth. However, there's another issue. The Yesh Lefakpek Bezeksatz, you can take issue with this. The Yesh Hefsik Bein Kriyas HaMakre LaMiras Kohanim. There's an interruption, a hefsik, between the point where the Makre, the one who's prompting the Kohanim, the Chazan, or whoever it may be, says the word, and the Kohanim's response. And that's not appropriate either. Ubishlam Etshim Menagnim, if they're singing anyway, Efshar Digam Zehu Bechal Hascholas Amiras HaTeva. If they're singing, it may be considered as if they've begun to start the word. So instead of saying v'yishmerecha, they go, ay, 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 v'yishmerecha. So it's going right into the word. So perhaps it's not a hefsik because the niggun leads right into the word. It's like they're about to say the word until they say it. However, in some shuls, they just remain quiet. They give them whatever it is, a minute, 2 minutes, and then they say the word. Is that proper? It's a hefsik. Avokish Shoskim, a line down, Ma'ika Lameimar. And he quotes the Gemara that we've read in the Shirim in the morning, V'ein HaKohanim Yecholim, to say what they have to say, L'vareich Ad Shetichra HaTeva Mipi HaMakre, until the word leaves the mouth of the reader, U'mashma Milashon Zed, Acha Shekola HaMakre, Tekev Tzvichim Lanos. The sense of that phrase is, as soon as the reader prompts the Kohanim, they should immediately respond. That's the whole idea, as we said. The Chazan prompts the Kohanim. It's an idea of a Kala Zel Zev. The Amar possibly that they respond to the call, just like they respond to the call of Kohanim in the very beginning, when they begin Duchening. They respond to the call of each and every word. And here they don't have that. You have this Hefsik. And therefore, the very end of what he says, if you just go down a line, U'be'emes ha'lo mevor b'kama rishonim b'tam kriyas ha'makra, another reason given for why we prompt the Kohanim, hu shelo yitu, so that they not get confused. Don't forget, you have words that repeat themselves, Hashem, Elecha, so that in order that they not get confused, they have to constantly be prompted for the word. U'kshel yimshach ha'davar, if it gets swept out with the singing, efshar she'yavo lidei tos, and again they'll get confused. So you've defeated the whole purpose of why you're prompting the Kohanim when they schlep out with the tune, then they get confused, and it happens sometimes. In fact, I've seen it. You're at V'yishmerecha, and then, or vice versa, you're V'chuneka, and the Kohen's been so long singing, the Kohen says V'yishmerecha, or V'chuneka. If you're responding right away to the call, then you know what you're supposed to say. If you're singing for a few minutes, then sometimes you can forget which tune you're at, or which point you're at the bracha. Therefore, he says, the bottom line is, Al kol panim mehanachon l'tzibur shelo yimshechu harbe b'amirasam. The advice given is to the tzibur not to take too long when they say Ribono Shel Olam. Say it as quickly as you could, and let the Kohanim quickly say what they have to say, so you don't get involved in hefsik or confusion or anything else. So when people complain they don't have enough time, the answer should be, doesn't matter. Rush yourself and say it as quickly as you could. That's what emerges from the Mishnah Berurah. Now, what have I not answered is what we do the third time. So we have the tefillah recited two times. That we saw earlier with the Hagolos Maimonios, that you say it three times. But we have it two times, and we have a tefillah called Yehi Ratzon during the third time. In fact, the Mishnah Berurah here on page 7 does not advocate saying Yehi Ratzon. Say the tefillah two times, and when it comes to shalom, just let the Kohanim say shalom and move on. Or if you're going to say something, say the Ribono Shel Olam again. But he does not recommend saying Yehi Ratzon. On page number 7, notice a letter Hey in the Mishnah Berurah. The sense you get from the Mechaber is that you're saying the tefillah each time for shalom as well. This is what he points out. That you would do a sayin bahadi kahani, vahainu besof, this is about, again, 7 lines from the bottom, where you have the hey. Besof ko pasuk, at the end of every pasuk, shemisayimim, vehem gimu pa'amim. So 3 times you're saying ribono shel olam. Vehem kasuk b'shem hagra, shahayin noe groma gam besof pasuk gimu haribono shel olam hanal. He would say ribono shel olam 3 times, not as we have it here, but 3 times, once again after shalom. Shehuskar b'gemara, because that's what we really have seen in the Gemara. We've seen the Gemara once, but if you're going to do it at the end of every pasuk, do it consistently 3 times. V'lo ha'yehi ratzon ha'nidfas b'sidurim. What I remember in yeshiva, when I was in near yeshiva in Brooklyn, was they did it twice. When it came to shalom, there would just be a clap, which meant the Kohanim just said shalom, and nobody would say anything. And I always wondered then at the time, why isn't anyone saying anything? Why don't we get a chance to sing 3 times? But they didn't give us an opportunity to sing 3 times. They just had to sing twice, and it came to shalom. You heard that. And whoever starts saying something new, they should stop immediately, and the Kohanim would just say shalom, and that would be the Birkat Kohanim. It's based on what we've just seen in the name of the Gra. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The last Yehirat is correct. The Tefillah of Yehirat comes from Kabbalah. It's true. It's true. Right. You can see from the tefillah itself. You do see that. Again, I'm not saying anything to Paskin. I'm just pointing out some of the issues, and when it comes to exactly how one should practice, that's something to ask the Rav. But yes. Let's just take a moment to look at the actual text of the tefillah itself. One thing I'd like to call your attention to is something you see on page number 4 in the Prisha, which is in the middle of the page. One says, if they need healing, you should heal it like you healed the waters of Marah, like you healed Miriam from her leprosy, like you healed Chizkiyahu from his illness, and like you healed the waters of Yericho through Elisha. Prisha says something quite interesting. He says, the comparison is, I won't read it inside, but you can take a look on yourself, it's 4 and 4a. The power of the tefillah of Ribono Shel Olam is not just to bring to fruition a good dream, and more than that, it's not just to bring a bad dream to neutralize its impact, but even more than that, it's to take a bad dream and to transform it into good. That's the text, that's the meaning of Atavas Chalom, and that's what we saw in the other ritual with the 3 people. It will be good, it will be transformed to good. The concept of transformation is what we see in each of these cases. It wasn't just that the water, the bitter water at Marah, was no longer bitter. The water in Marah, which was bitter, became sweet. And so on, he says, with all of the other examples. The fact that Miriam became cleansed of her leprosy wasn't just that she became back to where she was, but it brought about a tremendous inspiration for Klal Yisrael then when they saw the power of Lashon Hara and what it can do to somebody. It brought about tshuva and the other things as well with Elisha and Chizkiyahu, brought about a Kiddush Hashem. And that's what we're saying with our tefillah. We want our dreams not just to become parav, but we want them to become positive, a force for good. Something else which I'll also just call your attention to, we don't have time to go into it in depth, but I think it's worth going through on your own. On page 8 and 8A, I have here a series of commentaries by Rav Kook on Agada, and his phenomenal work called Ein Aya. Rav Kook just has a lot of very beautiful insights into this tefillah, which again, we don't have time to go through, but just something that I'll share is the way he looks at the very opening statement here. Ribono shel Olam, how do you begin? Ani shelach, v'chalomosai shelach, chalom chalamti v'ein yodea mahu. I am yours, my dreams are yours. It's a very strange way to begin. If you want to start off the tefillah, say, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, chalom chalamti. I've dreamt a dream and I don't know what it is. Please, if it needs to be strengthen it. What is this introduction? I am yours and my dreams are yours. What is the idea here? So Rav Kook says, we have to think about the connection between dreams and Birchas Kohanim to begin with. What really do these two things have in common? So Rav Kook says that Birchas Kohanim symbolizes the concept that there's nothing in this world that is not under divine hashgacha. That means everything. That means everything about a person. Everything in a person's life, everything a person thinks about or ever thought about, every emotion that a person feels or has or will have, every mood that a person is in at any given moment is all part of a divine hashgacha. It's just that all of these things are just forces. They don't necessarily point for themselves, but they end up blending together, interacting, and bringing out results based on what they do to you. You have a certain emotion, you feel a certain way, and based on that, you act, and things happen, and people interact with each other. But it's not just the end result that matters, that's part of the divine plan, but it's all of these earlier stages that brought out what came about later on as a result that are also part of a divine hashgacha. That's the concept of Birchas Kohanim, HaKadosh Baruch Hu blesses us and everything is under His control and His hashgacha, His providence. Even the concept of the Kohanim spreading out their hands symbolizes the concept of these forces, emotions and so on, feelings, and how they express themselves into the world. And that's the concept of spreading out your hand, the idea of from potential to reality. Not only a person's emotions and feelings, but even the very reality about how a person thinks about their dreams. Why is it that some people think the dreams are nothing and they shrug it off, and other people take it very seriously? They're almost superstitious. Why is it that some people remember the dreams more easily than others, and other people almost never remember their dreams? The very relationship that one has to his or her dream is itself a function of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's divine plan. And this is what he says in the beginning of the paragraph of Nun Dalet. Ani shelach v'chalomosai shelach. This is how we begin. I am yours and my dreams are yours. What are dreams? Dreams are many things, but dreams are also a function of our thoughts, our imaginations, what we think about. But even that is shelach. That's yours too. Kevan sha'ata ribon ko ha-metziyus. That's why ribon ha-shalom. You're the master of everything. V'ani shalach she'yitzartani kuli b'chachma. You created me with wisdom. V'asi salias ha-nefesh ha-zos. And you made this soul im kol rikshoseha with all of its emotions and feelings. V'gam ha-yachas she'beini u'bein chalomosai. Even the very relationship between myself and my dreams. Kimo ha-zichron v'ha-shikcha. Whether I remember it or if I forget it, gam ele lo bo b'mikra, even that has not come coincidentally, kiyem apichach maschah ha'elyona, but also through your own wisdom, hamalei tzedek u'mishpat v'rachamim, which is full of justice and mercy. Al kein, therefore, hineni b'tzedek machlit, I can justifiably state, shegam ze ha'mikra, even this very thing, shall iyidi asiyas hachalom, that I don't know what my dream is, I don't know what I've dreamt, I don't know what it means, that reality, gam ze eno yotze miseder hakoli shel chachmasecha ha'el yonah, that does not leave your divine Mishkim, Sheman Heges HaKol HaTov, which directs everything for good. And that's a lesson that lies within Birchas Kohanim. I think it's a very profound idea that perhaps we takes us a little time to contemplate and to digest. But this is how he fits it into the very text of the bracha. Nishalach, Rachalom Osei Shalach, Chalom Chalamti V'en Yedei Amahi, and that's also yours. That goes back to you as well. Everything is within, right. The idea of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's bracha is that everything is HaKadosh Baruch Hu's bracha, and everything can be channeled toward bracha. Everything in the world, on every level. That's what he's suggesting. I promised you to just complete some loose ends from last Shabbos. So what I'd like to do is read to you two stories that illustrate the power of dreams even in our day and age. We mentioned how dreams can be prophetic and may have some divine message for us. And that's how we saw in the Gemara. That's why we have Tanis Chalom when we have it. Even today, theoretically speaking, we can have Tanis Chalom and Hatavas Chalom and the Ribon Shel Olam. That means that dreams may have something to them. This is a story that's contained in a letter. The letter was from a Rav Mordechai of Slonim to Rav Pinchas Michael of Antipolia. Rav Pinchas Michael's drashos were reproduced and edited by Rabbi Abba Zions. And in the Sefer called Drashos HaRapam, Drashos of Pinchas Michael, is contained what's called Igeret HaChalom, the letter of the dream. And it reads as follows. It speaks for itself. I am about to relate an extraordinary episode which you will obviously refrain from revealing to anyone. You are to hide the letter, to tear it up, so that its contents may never become known. Okay. But we have it. This past Erev Yom Kippur, while engrossed in my usual studies, I fell into deep slumber, in the course of which I had a dream. And behold, in my dream there appeared a man of handsome features. Upon seeing him, I was overwhelmed, as he to the extent that I have been sent to instruct you on what you have to do in order to annul the evil decree. I then said to him, but I know not the nature of the decree or what must be done. To the extent that I have been sent to instruct you on what you have to do in order to annul the evil decree. I then said to him, but I know not the nature of the decree or what must be done. For some time the man remained silent. As for me, I began to weep in my dream, and I said, I know not what is this heavy sin that I have committed, that messengers are sent to me from on high. My weeping shook me out of my sleep, but no longer did I think the dream was vain. For now I was sure that it contained a message. During the day of Shmini Atzeres, I felt myself overcome with elation, and again I could not find the reason for such unprecedented joy. Then, during the night of Simchas Torah, the man of grandeur appeared to me again in my dream. He was once more dressed in white, and his appearance was most awe-inspiring. He came near and cried, "How long must I be troubled to come to you from my sacred abode?" I gathered courage and said to him, "By the merits of the Torah, the Tanoim and Amoraim, to the study of whose words I have dedicated myself, I implore you to tell me the nature of your mission and to explain it in a manner that I can understand." He thereupon led me into an exquisitely decorated room, the beauty of which is beyond words, and said unto me, "Be seated, my son, and I shall reveal to you a secret, for that is my mission." We both sat down, and he said, "I am revealing a secret to you. Know that I am Mahari ben Lev." Mahari ben Lev lived in Turkey in the 1500s. He wrote responsa known as Tshuvos Mahari ben Lev. "Know that I am Mahari ben Lev, and when I was among the living, I judged between men. Once two men came before me, and the one who was adjudged guilty refused to abide by the decision. I gave him the customary warning and left the room. But this person followed me and struck me on the cheek." Once again, this has been documented as a historical fact. In the preface, they cite this story as well. "The sin has remained indelibly etched in his bones to this day, and he has had no redemption. But now it has been decreed that you, as one of his descendants, must restore him to the state of redemption." I was overcome with shock at this revelation and remained as in a coma for some time. Then Mahari ben Lev touched my lips and said, "Why are you silent?" Whereupon I began to weep deeply and said, "I know not how to redeem him, for I am ignorant in such matters." Mahari ben Lev then said, "It has been decreed that you obtain my works," Tshuvos Mahari ben Lev, responsa of Mahari ben Lev, "and study them until you know them by memory. This will bring about the redemption, and you will also be able to elevate your own self from degree to degree." I asked him to explain the meaning of the degrees, but he said, "Why seek to learn the secrets of the Almighty?" I then asked him, "How long a time would I spend in study to know your works by memory?" "Not less than 4 years," he answered, "for during this time you must also continue with your regular studies." "But I do not have the responsa," I said. "Look for them," was the reply, "and you'll be able to buy them. And this too I reveal to you. They must be bought from the rabbi of Antipolia who possesses them, and from none other." "But why only from this rabbi?" I asked. And in the midst of this query I awoke, greatly troubled. The necessity of buying the books from this rabbi appeared to me to be meaningless, since they could be obtained elsewhere as well. My numerous duties as a rabbi of the community took up my time, and I therefore asked several people to get the books for me. But 2 weeks ago, the man of Grindur appeared to me once again in my dreams, and he reproached me, "Why do you hesitate in fulfilling my mission?" "But I am trying to buy the books," I replied, and he said, "Did I not admonish you to purchase them only from the rabbi of Antipolia?" "But why," I insisted, "since you are privileged to study with him," and they were studying for many years together as chavrusas, "you are now privileged to be sent with a mission to him. I shall reveal to you that there are complaints on high against this rabbi, for he has begun to prepare for publication a commentary on the tractates Temura and Me'ilah." Now he adds in parentheses, "I do not recall whether he mentioned both or Me'ilah only, and he has not completed this project. This he must now rectify. With the money that he will receive from you for the responsa, he will be able to begin publishing his work." "What has one thing to do with another?" I asked. "Why seek to know the secrets of the Almighty?" was his reply. "Then why do you not relate this matter in person to the rabbi of Antipolia?" I persisted. "Why seek to know the secrets of the Almighty?" he repeated, then called out loudly, "For the sake of the Almighty, take care to fulfill my admonition at once, without changing one iota of what I have told you." From the loudness, I woke up. On the morrow, I wanted to send a special messenger to you to apprise you of the entire matter, but I was delayed by several communal problems. Last week, my wife became seriously ill, and in my sleep, Mahari ben Lev appeared and said to me, "Know that this is the last warning. Your wife's illness is the result of your negligence. Take heed, therefore, and send immediately to the rabbi of Antipolia and buy my responsa from him. Then study them until you shall be well versed in them. I awoke overcome with fear and wanted to hire a special messenger sent to you. But I learned that the bearer of this letter was journeying to you for personal reasons. Therefore, my teacher and master, have mercy and compassion with me. Spread your wings of pity over me and send me the responsa at whatever price they may be. But please hasten in sending the books to me so that I may begin my task. My wife is dangerously ill. May God have mercy on her. I ask you to pray for her. Your cordial friend who writes cheerfully and from the depth of his heart, Mordechai. Just one short story to conclude. Rabbi Gifter himself was involved in something of a similar nature. About 10 years ago, he was boarding a plane in Cleveland for a wedding of a Talmud in New York. There were 8 others that boarded the plane with him. Talmidim, colleagues. One of the people was Rabbi Lindinsky, who's a Rav in Seattle. And he was the one who was an eyewitness to this and began to beg him to say Kaddish for him. He looked to his father in his dream and he said, how could I say Kaddish for you? I'm still furious at you. I'm still angry at you. I'm not talking to you. Besides, where on earth can I get a minion? I work in an airport. There's no shul anywhere near here. And his father said to him, don't worry, my son. I will send you a minion. Naturally, they came late to the wedding. Rav Gifter went to the chassan and said, we couldn't make your wedding because we had a previous engagement in Washington.
Okay. Oh, good evening, everyone. Do you have the sheets? All right. Over the last few decades, it's been rather common to find people claiming to be vegetarians that they will not eat meat, they're only vegetables. So of course, when all new fads such as these come into effect, it's important that we take a look to see how does Judaism view this? What's the Jewish view on vegetarianism? So we have to think, well, why should it be a problem at all, in fact? Does Judaism ever require us to eat meat? Can anyone think? Yes, you think so?
From Pesach.
Any other possibilities? Any other times? Yeah, excuse me? Shabbos and Yom Tov. Well, true. I think Korban Pesach, one is required to eat Korban Pesach, but
said to him, don't worry, my son, I will send you a minion. Naturally, they came late to the wedding. Rav Gifter went to the chassan and said, we couldn't make your wedding because we had a previous engagement in Washington.
Oh, good evening, everyone. Do you have the sheets? All right. Over the last few decades, it's been rather common to find people claiming to be vegetarians that they will not eat meat, they'll only eat vegetables. So, of course, when all new fads such as these come into effect, it's important that we take a look to see how does Judaism view this? What's the Jewish view on vegetarianism? So, we have to think, well, why should it be a problem at all, in fact? Does Judaism ever require us to eat meat? Can anyone think? Yes, you think so?
From Pesach.
Any other possibilities? Any other times? Yeah, excuse me? Shabbos and Yom Tov. Well, true. I think Korban Pesach, one is required to eat the Korban Pesach. But today, we don't have the Korban Pesach anymore. So it's not really an issue today anymore. We don't have any korbanos. However, the idea of Shabbos and Yom Tov is a problem we have to deal with. So if we look on the sheets I've given out, if you have one, source number one, there are two sides to some of the sheets. The one that says vegetarianism and halacha considerations Shabbos. You have that side? So you have source number one, which is the Rambam. He's discussing the idea of oneg Shabbos, this idea that on Shabbos you're supposed to enjoy your Shabbos, it's supposed to be a very nice time. So halacha yud, he says, Achilas Basos Shdias Yayin B'Shabbos Oneg Hulo, that eating meat and drinking wine on Shabbos is an oneg for him. It's oneg Shabbos for someone to eat meat and drink wine. So it sounds like the Rambam is saying that on Shabbos one is supposed to eat meat and drink wine. But is he really saying this? On Shabbos, for instance, you're not allowed to fast. You're supposed to eat. Why? Again, the idea of oneg Shabbos. If you fast, so you're not going to be enjoying your Shabbos. Most people do not like to fast. Well, let's say you like to fast. Let's say, for instance, you don't eat regularly, and if you were to have to eat on Shabbos, so that would be very unpleasurable for you. That would not be an oneg for you at all. In fact, not eating would be pleasurable. That would be an oneg Shabbos. So are you allowed to do that? Well, the Shulchan Aruch number 2 discusses this issue. He says in Halacha Aleph, Asur letanos b'Shabbos adav shos. It's forbidden to fast on Shabbos for the first 6 hours of the day. Not only are you not allowed to fast the whole day, not even the first 6 hours, you must eat during the first 6 hours of the day. Beis, yesh omrim, some say, she'adam she'mazik lo ha'achila, thus oneg hu lo she'lo le'achol le'achol. What about a person who, if he were to eat, it would be injurious to him, it would hurt him, and in that case, it would be an oneg for him to not eat, so then he should not eat. So says the Shulchan Aruch. And the Rama says, V'chem yishyesh lo oneg, em yifke kedei she'yelech, hatzar milibo mutar lifkos b'Shabbos. Similarly, one shouldn't cry on Shabbos, one should be in a happy mood, but if a person were to cry, this would make him feel better, so he's allowed to also cry on Shabbos. And Gimel, Adam ha'mas'anem b'chol yom v'chile b'Shabbos tzaru lo, nei shinu yivetha, seishom shiroi kama chasidim, v'anshei ma'isa, she'asana b'Shabbos m'tamzeh. A similar idea, people who fast daily, they often fast, eat very little. So if they were to have to eat on Shabbos, this would be very painful for them because of the change in eating habits. So also they're allowed to fast on Shabbos. So I think you see that if you're allowed to fast on Shabbos, if this is your oneg Shabbos, so certainly you would not be required to eat meat if you don't enjoy meat. If for some reason you don't want to eat meat, you would not be required to do so on Shabbos. But there's also a question, as we mentioned, on Yom Tov. On Yom Tov, there's a bigger idea of oneg Shabbos. Because the pasuk says, "V'samachta b'chagecha," you're supposed to enjoy Shabbos. Perhaps on Yom Tov, one would be required to eat meat. Well, let's look at number 5. Keset haktanim, nosim leham koyos v'gozim migdanos. So, how do ketanim, small children, enjoy Yom Tov? So it says you give them things that children like. You give them nuts, you give them little presents, you buy them little toys, whatever kids may like. B'hanashim, what about women? Konohem begadim v'tachshitim naim v'kifi mamono. You buy them nice clothing, nice jewelry, we all know what women like. Nice clothing, nice jewelry, perfume perhaps, whatever they may like. This way they'll say, wow, Yom Tov, what a happy day. I love Yom Tov. B'hanashim, what do men like? What will make them happy? Ochlim basa, they eat meat, good steak, v'shos and yayin, have good beer or wine, whatever they may enjoy. Shein simcha ala basa, v'ein simcha ala b'yayin. For there is no meat, there is no joy except for meat, and there is no joy except for wine. So Rambam says, why on Yom Tov, to enjoy Yom Tov, one should eat meat and drink wine. Seems like the Rambam is saying that one is required to eat meat on Shabbos, on Yom Tov. But is this really so? So let's take a look at number 6. This is the Beis Yosef. He writes, if you see the large print, Kosav HaRambam. The Rambam writes, Tarach Adam Leil Sameach V'Tov Leif B'Moed Ad V'lo Yimshichu B'Yayin Shema Yivo Yidei Aver HaKol Preg Zayin Masha Kosev Rabbeinu V'Anashim Ochlin Basta V'Shos In Yayin V'Sayim HaRambam She'ein Simcha El Basta V'in Simcha El B'Yayin. So of course the Rambam is saying that to properly enjoy Yom Tov, one must eat meat and drink wine. But he asks a question on the Rambam. U'Perek Avei Psochim Tanu Rabbanan Chayiv Adam V'Sameach Banov Nebesa Beregel. Person is required to make his household happy on Yom Tov. The Mem Samchen, how does one make them happy? The Yayin, and wine, with wine. Yehuda Omer, Yehuda says, Anashim B'Roi Lehem V'Nashim B'Roi Lehem. With men, things that they enjoy, and with women, things that they enjoy. Anashim B'Roi Lehem B'Yayin. V'Nashim B'Roi Lehem Tanya Rabbi Yosef B'Vavah B'Vigdei Tzivonim. So what do women like? Women like colored clothing, nice, pretty clothing. Eretz Yisrael, the gay pishah meguhatim. In Eretz Yisrael, they like flax linen clothing, which is ironed and pressed and looks very beautiful. Tanya, Rabbi Yehuda ben Becerra, Mary Yehuda ben Becerra says, "Bizman shebeis mikdash kayam ein simcha al basar." When the Beis Mikdash was around, so then there's only simcha by eating meat. Shemar v'tzvach toshamim v'chal tosham v'samachta. V'achshav, however nowadays, she'ein Beis Mikdash Kayim, when the Beis Mikdash is no longer around, ein simcha ela b'yayin. So today, how do we have Simchas Yontif? Only by drinking wine. Shemar, the pasuk says, V'ayin samach l'vav enosh. This is more of a Rambam. So Beis Yosef says, this Rambam is very strange. How do you understand this Rambam? Lam hitzlich shiyachu basa v'shtu yayin. The b'braitha kasani, the b'zman hazeh, ain simch ala b'yayin. Marash v'yayin sagi b'lo basa. So he says, this Gemara seems to say that nowadays, one enjoys Yontif only by drinking wine, and no longer by eating meat. So how can the Rambam say that one should have to eat meat today? So he says, I don't think the Rambam's right. You really should not have to eat meat today on Yontif, for Simchas Yontif. So you see that it's not so simple. It seems that one would not be required to eat meat on Yontif. Let's take a look on the second page, number 10. Here's the Gemara from Maseches Chulin. The Gemara is discussing an interesting topic, and we'll see from what actually the Gemara does not say, rather than what the Gemara does say, an interesting point on our topic. So the Gemara is asking an interesting question. We know that an animal which is mortally wounded, so that it will die in the near future, is not a kosher animal. Even if you were to shecht it properly, this animal would not be kosher. It's called a treifa. Now, you can check the animal after you shecht it to see if it was actually wounded. But isn't it also possible that perhaps in the place you shechted it, it was wounded in that spot? And therefore, if you look at the animal after you shechted it, well, you can't tell if it was really wounded previously because your shechting has obliterated that spot. But then again, how often does that happen? Very slight cases, huh? Maybe never. Very few. One in a million chance. Can we rely on that majority and say, well, it probably never happens. Let's assume it didn't happen here. Or can't we? So that's the question. That's the question being discussed in this Gemara. So let me read it. Number 10. Rabbi Ashi added, I put forward this argument to Rav Kahana. Others say, Rav Kahana put forward this argument to Rav Shimi. And he replied, perhaps the law is that where it is possible to ascertain the facts, we must do so. It is only where it is impossible to ascertain the facts, we follow the majority. For if you do not accept this argument, then the question will be asked, did Rabbi Meir, who was of the opinion that the minority must be taken into consideration, always abstain from eating meat? And if you reply that this indeed was the case, then it will be asked, what about the meat of the Paschal lamb and of other sacrifices? You are therefore obligated to say that Rabbi Meir's view is, where it's possible to ascertain the facts, one must do so. And only where it's impossible to ascertain the facts, does one follow the majority. We ask on Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir, who says that you always take the minority into consideration. So what would he hold in this case? Would he say, well, you always have to assume that maybe the animal is really treif, and maybe you just can't tell anymore. Did he hold that? Well, if he held that, then he would have to say that every animal is treif. He would never be able to eat any meat. Did he really do that? Well, if you want to say, yeah, okay, Rabbi Meir didn't eat meat. Let's say that's true. What of it? But that can't be. Because, well, then how about the Korban Pesach? How about other korbanos, other sacrifices? He has to eat those. So obviously you can't say that Rabbi Meir never ate meat. But what does the Gemara not say? The Gemara does not say, what about Shabbat? What about Yontif? How could he fulfill the mitzvah of only Shabbos, only Yontif? Doesn't he have to eat meat there? Since it didn't say that, we can infer that actually there is no obligation to eat meat on those days. Okay, fine. So let's say there is no obligation to eat meat. Well, how does the Torah view the idea that one should refrain from eating meat on, say, a moral basis? Let's just think about the moral considerations in this idea. If we look at number 7, we see that originally, God gave Adam only fruit and vegetables to eat. He did not give man animals to eat. I'll read the psukim in the Hebrew. V'varach osam elokim v'yom alhem elokim peru uvu melu asaretz v'chiv shuha. So God blessed man and he said, peru uvu, be fruitful, multiply, conquer the earth. V'edu b'dgas hayom u'fashamayim v'chol chayas. Passage 29, God says, I've given you every plant, every fruit tree, that's for you to eat. So he says also to all the animals in the world, to them I've given fruit, but not animals. What changes? After the flood, after Noah is in the Teva, and he gets out. So God blesses Noach. He says in Pasuk Aleph, "Vayivarech Hashem es Noach, v'es banav, v'yomer lahem pruvu mulu es ha'aretz." He says, "Be fruitful, multiply again." Marachem etzchem yal kol chayas ha'aretz, v'al kol of hashemayim, v'chol asher tumosa adama, v'chol degayam yedchem itanu. Korem es asher chayim lachem yal liachla. Pasuk 3, God says, anything that lives, anything that crawls on the ground, I've given it to you to eat. Just like until now you've been allowed to eat fruit and vegetables, growing things, now you're also allowed to eat meat. So some people say, well look, originally God told Adam only to eat vegetables, so perhaps we should also today revert to that state. Now I think if you want to take that approach, you have to understand why did God originally tell Adam only to eat vegetables? Why did he later tell Noach that he could eat meat? So the Ramban explains like this. He says, originally God said, don't eat animals. Why? Because in a certain sense, animals and men and man have a kinship. They have similar organs, they have legs and feet and arms, unlike plants. And they're conscious, they move around. They have a certain kinship. It was not proper for man to kill an animal, something that was very similar to man. However, after the flood, so God saw that man became weaker. They're becoming weaker ever since creation. And God decided that for their diet, they needed animals. They needed the protein. So God then permitted the animals to them. So if the reason is as follows, because it's a nutrition, so I think to say that one should not eat meat today because originally God did not want man to eat meat is fallacious. Because God is actually permitting us to eat meat for our own benefit. To say I want to go back to originally was, I don't think that that's actually a proper perspective. Trying to be more holy than God doesn't seem that this should really be a requirement. But let's think on our own. Probably most of you have met vegetarians, have thought about why people are vegetarians. Why do you think people are vegetarians? What are the reasoning in their heads? What do they think? Anyone here have an idea? Yes? Excuse me? What is cruel? To eat the animal? To kill the animal. Okay. Any other ideas? Health reasons. Is that what you're going to say?
More or less aesthetic. That is, that this was a lamb, this was a cow, and now the kids identify the living, and suddenly the meat doesn't feel right. It's aesthetic.
Mm-hmm. So is that like a cruelty type of thing?
No, it's just aesthetic. I mean, the lamb was
a living being.
A little kid, you know, a being.
Are you saying it's morally wrong to take the animal's life?
I don't think a little kid had that concept of morally wrong. It just didn't. Little kids, when they identify the meat as being that living lamb, don't feel right about it.
Okay.
It's not a moral thing. It's just an aesthetic thing.
Okay. Some people also have the view that just like it's morally wrong to take the life of a human being, it's morally wrong to take the life of an animal. This is an interesting idea, because the Sefer Ikarim has a very fascinating explanation for the story of Cain and Hevel. Cain and Hevel. As we know, Cain and Hevel were two brothers, both were the sons of Adam and Chava, and Cain brought an offering to God of fruit and vegetables, and the sacrifice, this offering, was not accepted by God. Hevel, on the other hand, brought an animal sacrifice, and this was accepted by God. Cain is very jealous. He went and he killed his brother Hevel, and that's the first murder recorded in the Torah. Sefer Karim has a very unusual understanding of the story. He says, why did Cain bring the offering of fruit? Because he felt that it's morally wrong to take the life of an animal. Just like it's morally wrong to take the life of a human being, animals and human beings, they're the same. Just like it's improper to kill one, it's improper to kill the other. So therefore he brought the vegetable, the fruit offering. Hevel, on the other hand, said no. Man is superior to animals. It is wrong to take the life of man. However, it is not wrong to take the life of an animal if you're going to use it as a sacrifice to God. So he sacrificed the animal because God did not like Cain's understanding. He did not accept the sacrifice. Hevel sacrificed whatever he did. When Cain saw that Hevel's sacrifice, his animal sacrifice, was accepted, he said, "Oh, I see, I was mistaken." He sacrificed an animal and it was accepted. Obviously, there's nothing wrong with killing animals. And since animals and people are the same, he didn't change his mind about that. He said, must be okay to kill people too. So he went and he killed his brother. So therefore, after the flood, God said to Noah, "You should know, animals you can eat. Animals are not on a level as human beings. They're on a lower level. It is certainly improper to say that, well, it's morally wrong to kill people. It's also morally wrong to kill animals." Now let's look at number 9. Source number 9 is a quote from Gemara Baba Metzia. Some people use this incident recorded in the Gemara here as a support for vegetarianism. So let's take a look at it to see if this is really true. This story is about Rebbe. Now Rebbe, during a certain portion of his life, suffered many tribulations, much suffering. And the Gemara says they came to him through a certain incident. A story that happened in his life. Because of a certain story, God gave him the suffering. What is it? What was the story? What happened? A calf was being taken to the slaughterer. When it broke away, it hit its head under Rabbi's skirts. And lowed in terror. The animal was hiding behind Rebbe, away from the butcher, because it did not want to be slaughtered. It could sense the fact that it was going to be slaughtered. "So go," said Rebbe, "for this is why you were created. You were created to be slaughtered and to be eaten by man." Thereupon they said in heaven, "Since he has no pity on the animal, let us bring suffering upon him." Let me just read the second part of the story. "And departed likewise. The suffering left Rebbe also because of the story." How so? One day, Rebbe's maidservant was sweeping the house. Seeing some young weasels lying there, she made to sweep them away. To sweep away the weasels. "Let them be," said he to her. "It is written, and his tender mercies are all over his works. So they in heaven, since he is compassionate, let us be compassionate to him." So suffering went away. So what can we see from the first part of the story? The animal cowered behind Rebbe. The animal was afraid of being slaughtered. Rebbe said, "Go. Go be slaughtered." And because he said this, suffering came upon him. It seems that it was improper for Rebbe to say, "Go and be slaughtered." Right? It seems that slaughtering the animal is not a proper thing. So this vegetarians take this Gemara as support for their position that actually slaughtering animals is wrong. However, the Mefarshim don't really see it this way. The Maharsha says, no, animals were given to man to eat. There was nothing wrong with slaughtering animals. What was wrong in the story? Well, here we're talking about a young calf. A young calf, and usually, he says, you use animals first to plow with, first to work with. When they're getting a little older, then you slaughter them. But it was such a young animal, just born, really should have felt something. He should have felt some mercy for the animal. The fact that he said, "Go, go, you were created for that purpose," didn't seem to show any compassion for this animal. So, on Rebbe's level, this was not proper, and therefore he deserved the suffering. For instance, let's look at number 11. The Gemara starts by quoting the pasuk in Parshas Noach. "And every living substance was destroyed, which was upon the face of the ground, both man and cattle, by the flood." So Gemara asks, I think, a very good question. If man sinned, if man committed crimes during the time before the flood, how did the beast sin? Why did the animals deserve to die? A Tanna taught on the authority of Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha. "This may be compared to a man who set up a bridal canopy for his son. A man built a chuppah for his son and prepared a banquet with every variety of food. Subsequently, his son died. Whereupon he arose and broke up the feast, saying, 'Have I prepared all this for any but my son? Now that he is dead, what need have I of the banquet?' Thus the Holy One, blessed be he, said too, 'Did I create the animals and beasts for aught but man? Now that man has sinned, what need have I of the animals and beasts?'" So in this Gemara, it seems clear that God is saying the only reason why he created animals was to serve man. Once man was dying, once man was to be destroyed, animals had no more purpose. They were to be destroyed too. Now, there was, I think someone suggested cruelty back there. Now, of course, we all know that Judaism is very much against cruelty to animals. Tzar Bali Chayim, according to some opinions, is prohibited against the Torah, by Torah law. And we know we try to do everything to minimize suffering to animals when they are slaughtered. Many people feel that shechita is the least painful way of slaughtering. So, I don't know exactly what they do in the butcher houses. Certainly, it should be done in the least painful way. There are certain stories that animals are mistreated, and that would be improper. But that doesn't necessarily hinge on whether eating meat is an ideal. It should be a separate issue of how we should treat the animals. They certainly should not be mistreated in the slaughtering houses. Certainly should be killed as painlessly as possible. Let's take one look at the Abarbanel. There are some people who feel that by eating animals, or by refraining from eating animals, they develop better traits within themselves. Because eating animals, you know that they was killed by somebody, it makes some sort of a negative impression in their body, in their soul. So let's look at the Abarbanel. Number 12, the bottom corner. So this is Abarbanel on Sefer Bereishis, Parshas Noach. He says, why did God permit Noach to eat meat? Ma'ashalo, he had a live animal eating it. Certainly a very cruel thing to do, to rip off the limb of a live animal. So, just like there, by Abraham and Hachai's idea of cruelty, so too many people feel that if a person feels that by involving himself in the slaughter of animals, or even in the consumption of animals, will make him a crueler person, so that also would be a good reason to refrain from eating meat, if you personally felt that way. I want to conclude with a certain idea expressed in the Tanya, by the Bavitcher Rebbe, the first one. He says that, a different idea, he says by eating meat, which is from an animal, a person eats meat, and with this meat he gains sustenance, he gains strength. And with this strength he goes, he learns Torah, he does mitzvos, he has sanctified that meat, he has raised the meat up to a higher level. The meat was just an animal, simple animal, who has no mitzvos, no Torah, just walks around the earth, has no free will. But he has taken this meat, and he has sanctified the meat. He has made it part of himself. He has given himself sustenance and energy, and with that energy he has gotten the mitzvos, he has raised that meat to a higher level. He has indeed done something very noble. So there are two ways of looking at the issue. If one uses meat for positive things, it can be a good idea. However, there could also be negative things involved. Each person should decide on his own. Thank you very much.